Hello, everyone. It's Crystal here, one of your hosts for iAtsy891's podcast, Applebox Talks. It's been nearly 2 years since we released an episode of the podcast, and for many of us, a lot has changed in that time. Our industry, our people, have come through an incredibly challenging 2 years, and now we take stock of how we want to move forward with this work in the future. We're hoping to release Season 2 of Applebox Talks in 2025. Season 1 introduced you to some of the creative artists and technicians that make up the membership here and gave you a peek behind the curtain with our episodes focused on helping those new to the industry learn more about what it means to be a part of our local. In Season 2, we want to take a step back, looking more broadly at iAtsy891's role in both the motion picture industry and the greater labor movement here in BC. We're really excited about the upcoming interviews and the stories we will get to share with you in 2025. In the meantime, we've gone back to our archive and edited 6 previously unaired episodes from Season 1, and we'll be releasing those monthly for the rest of 2024. Since they were recorded in 2022, there are a few dated references, but there's still some excellent stories for you. So until we see you fresh again in 2025, pull up an Apple Box and let's talk. iAtsy891 presents Apple Box Talks,
the podcast where we get to talk to the very best in entertainment, the artists and technicians of iAtsy891.
From prep to post and everything in between, we create worlds on screens of all sizes. Welcome to Apple Box Talks. I'm Crystal.
And I'm Hillary. And this week we sit down with a legend of the BC industry who has worked in lighting, props, set decorating, and has also represented 891 as business representative and president.
His many roles and credits help build our now thriving industry. On the phone today from Powell River, we're excited to welcome George Chapman. So pull up an Apple Box and let's talk.
Welcome, George.
Hi, Hillary. Good morning.
Let's start at the beginning here, because you have such a beautiful history in this industry, in British Columbia specifically. Tell us about your origin story.
I guess the thing that struck me about your broadcast was growing the membership in new and diverse ways. And I have to admit that new and diverse is certainly all around us, but just like skinny ties, old ways are coming back too. So I look back on my old ways at marketing the Local 891 and 667, 669 IATSE locals at the time as being a marketing exercise, and my background was sales and marketing. And so it has come full circle in that regard.
So I heard a story about you driving from Montreal to LA and ending up with a very interesting chess partner. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I left the cold winters of Montreal and in 1963 and drove the old Route 66 down to LA. And I was traveling with friends that had a relative, Larry Butterworth, that was a makeup artist in L.A., and he put us up. And he put me up specifically in the cabana next to the pool. And he said, well, when you wake up in the morning, he said, usually I have an early start with my chess partner buddy. We've been playing chess either on location, wherever we've been on location, and at either of our homes. And so I woke up the next morning and walked in on a chess game between Larry Butterworth and John Wayne. And that blew me away. You know, John Wayne stood up. I was 6'1", and he was taller than I. And he put his hand out, and it was a John Wayne handshake. And after we talked a while, Larry said I was on my way up to Vancouver, and they both wished me well and suggested I get into the motion picture business. And that's where I found myself a year later.
So what was your first job when you entered the motion picture industry?
My first job was a catch-22 situation, which I'm sure many new entrance into the business these days that must have run across, and that was I went to Panorama Studios in West Vancouver, and I because they were starting prep on a movie called The Trap for J. Arthur Rank, or Oliver Reed and Rita Tushingham were the stars. And so I went in and I said, hey, here I am. I've been referred by John Wayne, and how could it get any better? I said that to myself. And naturally, they said, well, you can't work here unless you belong to a union. And so they said, and you can't work with a union unless you've got experience. And so I went off and beat the bushes, and I went to the Teamsters because they were hiring, and they said the same thing. So I got a job as a taxi driver, and I got my chauffeur's license, and then I got a few months under my belt, and I went back to the Teamsters and said, here I am. I've got experience. I'm a licensed chauffeur. And so I got on through the Teamsters. That was my first job. And my first job was driving the producers and director from the Sylvia Hotel up to on location Rec East and back and forth to the studio.
That's probably the best reference anyone could ever have in this industry, or one of the best references in John Wayne. So just looking back, you held these positions in the set decorating department, in the lighting department. What made you want to give back as a business representative, and what motivated you to run for president?
Well, I'd worked for 10 years, a full decade, as a business representative for Local 891. And then I took a job with Panavision Canada. It was a one-year job as national sales rep for 1 year, and it turned into a two-year experience. And in that 2 years, a lot of the spade work that we had done in the previous decade was decaying, and so I was asked to come back by quite a large number of friends and members to come back and run as president and see if we could tug it back online again. So I was elected to do that, and so I became president again, as there were when I was business rep elections every year. So I ran the first year as president, and then I got voted in again, and then I ran a second year. And by that time, we had done what we'd hoped to achieve, and we'd established the local from being members of any department that needed a member to work in to specific departments. And then the local never looked back after that.
So it sounds like you really were paving the way for, you know, more exposure to our foreign production that we now have quite a bit of here, and also really built sort of the recruitment, really built up sort of the base of our membership.
I was the only employee, first of all, at the time. And when we were building the membership, thinking back on the trap, we were tied to the hip, if you wish, to other locals, specifically Local 212 Calgary. There were only about 40 members in the local at the time, and most of them were stagehands trying to establish themselves in the film industry.
And just for perspective for everyone, back then there were 40, and now there's just about 10,000 members. So
that's right. It's incredible. And by the time I wrapped up being a business rep, there were about 5,000 members. So it's doubled since then, and it's been quite phenomenal. But getting back to the issue of that first picture, I learned as a lighting technician then on permit to operate a carbon arc brute for lighting. And Bill Newberry was our Canadian gaffer on the show, and Bill introduced me to the Merrill's brothers, who were out here from Calgary, and that established a long-time relationship. So when I became business rep, and we got more and more pictures, the logical thing to do was lean on the other IATSE locals across Canada, starting, of course, with Local 118, the stage local, which we all started from, and making sure I got everybody out of there that I could mine that that was wanted to work in film, and then the projectionists and the front of the house people and all IATSE at the time. And then, of course, the logical thing was to go to Calgary and beg people to come out. You know, we had a picture, and we could only half crew it. So I went to Calgary. I talked as many people as I could. I phoned them directly, and I did the same in Edmonton, Regina, Winnipeg, Toronto 873, Montreal, all the way back to the East Coast. And over the years, we got people like Don Sarri, who came out as a gaffer on By Design, along with many other people that came out to do By Design. And that's how we grew. And most of our pictures, I found the easiest pickings in terms of sales and marketing was Los Angeles. So, and I was always accused of stealing pictures from Hollywood. So after we exhausted our quest for more manpower from Canada, I went to the Hollywood locals, and I asked them if they could provide names of individuals and send us their credits so that I could put their names forward to productions, which we did. So the International was a little happier about what we were doing. We were stealing work from Hollywood, allegedly. But at the time, see, we didn't have any provincial or federal incentives. We didn't give money back. It was all based on the exchange rate. And fortunately for me, it was a whole lot easier sell because the dollar went all the way down to 65 cents at one point. And when it went above in the 80s, when it went above 80 cents on the dollar, I begged and pleaded and succeeded in getting everybody to peg the dollar at 80 cents so that budgets could be made on a finite budget exchange rate.
That's pretty incredible timeline you've just given us there. That's real groundbreaking, boots on the ground, literally boots on the ground all over North America. You know, I, for one, as a member for over a decade, appreciate that work that you've done, George.
Thank you.
So going back to some of the work that you were doing on set, you've worked in lighting, props, and set decorating. Can you tell us about some of your most memorable sets that you've been on?
McCabe and Mrs. Miller was one. I did lighting on that, actually. And that was the Warren Beatty, Julie Christie, and Robert Altman. And I got to know Altman, as we all did. We were up there, you know, all winter long, dragging ourselves around in the snow, fortified, by the way, with a real still happening. We had a corn mash still functioning, and in the morning you just took a little sip of that, and it went down, made your tummy warm, and you were all set for the day. So that was quite an experience. And and when I was on that show, and the first day I started, I saw in the, as they said in those days, the pretty department, it had a fellow named Ed Butterworth. So I went over to see if he was related to Larry, the chess player in L.A., and sure enough, it was Larry's brother. Ed said that Larry had passed away but he was a hairstylist. And so that was a nice little update. And I kept in touch with Larry. He ended up marrying a costume lady here in Vancouver named Ginny. And she moved down to L.A. with him. Yeah, so that was one of my, you know, certainly early and very memorable experiences in film.
It's interesting how everything kind of comes full circle. And we really do become like the a family of sorts. You also mentioned in your pre-interview An Unfinished Life quite a bit. Can you talk a little bit about that project?
Yeah, Unfinished Life was shot in Kamloops in 2003. That was one of my sales success stories. When I was with Panavision, just wrapping up with Panavision, I'd called on the studios, and one of the studios, I had done a breakdown and a preliminary budget for a show called Unfinished Life, and it was in development. And I found, too, that in those days, when I did a breakdown and a budget, I was usually asked to keep it confidential because we didn't want people banging on the door saying, I want to in on your picture, because some of these pictures in development take a few years before they happen. Luckily for me, I found myself out in the business as a production manager in 2003, and lo and behold, Unfinished Life raised its head, and they remembered me, and they hired me, and that was a great experience. I was up in Kamloops for 6 months, and it was Jennifer Lopez, Robert Redford, and Morgan Freeman production, and it was fabulous. And again, in that regard, we tried our best to hire local members, and especially members, IA members that lived in the interior, in the Okanagan specifically. So it was like old home week. My brother Barry was my longtime transportation coordinator, and it was just an absolutely great memory.
So you've seen a lot of change in the film industry, and one thing that we're often criticized about is that it's not really perceived as a sustainable career. What advice would you have to someone who's coming new into the industry?
Get a day job. Yeah. I can only relate to myself. By the time we got in the 80s, by the time we got the train up and running and moving along, day jobs became less and less important because you were busy all the time. But prior to that, I remember on the trap, they said, oh, this is it. This is Hollywood North, they were claiming. And this is going to be our careers forever. We'll never work another job, and we'll be in film heaven. And then we were plunged into unemployment for 6, 7, 8 months, maybe a year and a half. 40 or 30 even available members that initially numbered in Local 891, they got all the jobs. So as a permittee, it took me 7 years to get enough days to become a member in 1971. So it was a long time in between. So during that time, I did a variety of jobs, including becoming a manager of a fabricating company, and finally starting a company of my own, Bartlett Metal Products in Vancouver, manufacturing, a long way from films, mind you, manufacturing conveyors and food processing equipment. And I was quite successful until I still had the bug and I was lured back to film in the end.
It's interesting the history of the cyclical sort of work that you experienced back then, because now, as it is still cyclical, there is just so much more production and so many more opportunities out there. But really, you know, we are standing on the shoulders of folks like you and other members who really toughed it out and really carved the path here for the success that we have today in our industry. So, you know, there's a lot of sacrifices that our senior members have made, and we should all really recognize that, especially when we go through those cyclical phases and we complain and say, oh gosh, I haven't been called for a while, you know. It is a pressure point for us as film technicians and artists, but it definitely is far better than, you know, many, many years ago when members had to really tough it out.
I found, too, that I made it known to Local 118 that my future was in film, not on stage. But they hired us through their permittee system to work things like the Ice Capades and other shows. And so that certainly kept the wolf away from the door for those periods. And so you were interdependent between locals. And then, of course, I worked as a gaffer doing commercials and documentaries and student films and sponsored films. And when I did that, my friend Bill Newberry, our pioneer gaffer, he and Fred Ransom, who was a key grip and former president of IATSE, Local 891, he had a truck completely fitted out with all the lighting gear possible. And so it was wonderful. I took Bill's truck everywhere in the province, and that was my primary source of lighting equipment right there. Along with when I got on bigger shows, I leaned on George Margellis at William F. White and ProLight at the time, Bert Skelton, and that's another thing I think of Bert Skelton. He came from Beachcomber days, and that was a whole other source. We're talking about getting new members and to fill the ranks. Beachcombers was a great one, and many, many people that got into the business were Beachcomber pioneers. And I had a fellow of the name of John Rogers who was CBC, and Beachcombers was a CBC production. And between John and I, whenever I was looking for someone, he'd go down the CBC list and he'd come up with people that were ready to become freelance. And that was difficult, too, because people that, as they called it, the mother corp in those days, and people that worked a steady job at the CBC had a steady job to support their families, and it was frightening to consider actually coming out and maybe believing the hype that I was putting forward that they'll never look back. They came out and became freelancers, but we got a lot of really good people like Michael Bolton, for instance, who was our director on Beachcombers, and we got him out on Harry Tracy, Desperado. Bob Gray was on the trap with me. Bob was the production manager on Harry Tracy. And we pulled and tugged, and John Rogers pushed from the inside of the CBC, finally got Michael Bolton out. And Michael Bolton, you know, is a legendary art director to this day of Local 891.
So, George, you've touched on something that I think is still something we talk about now, is the perceived risk of getting into the film industry. So I know that you've addressed it a little bit, but for us as a local, what advice would you give us here about how to support members better to manage that risk, especially when they're talking about their friends and their families?
Well, I think the opportunity here at the moment is never stop growing. And you can't sit back and close the doors, as many unions have found to their peril. Close the doors and say, okay, I'm in. We don't want anyone new. But if you get new people in, you've got to provide work. And the work these days is in new media, and the opportunities are there. The streaming services, the Netflix, which weren't there when I was around. It was all studios and networks and broadcasters. So now there's a lot of opportunity for you as business reps to make sure that your name is front and center, and you're representing your members to take advantage and work on those shows because they pay more. Earlier this year, I had, although I've been retired for about 14 years now, I had a call out of the blue from a L.A. producer friend of mine saying that he wanted to shoot a feature in Alberta, and he wanted me to be his associate producer and line everything up for him, which I did. I got a hold of everybody I knew in Alberta, and we beat the bushes, and I got Murray Ord, who is a longtime location manager, to get involved, and we got very, very, very close on doing the show until finally, I think we were done in by COVID. We had to have a 6-week window for even the producers and the director to be able to come and work in Canada. So you had to apply 6 weeks ahead. So that was pushing the show forward, and they were deathly afraid of getting caught in winter weather if they pushed it into fall, which I think was unfounded because some of their best weather is in the fall. At any rate, we got to the point where there was just no time for them to wait, and COVID was breathing down their necks. So they went and got a deal with Denver. Now, the industry has changed a whole lot. In Canada, first of all, we could give rebates for below-the-line people and some actors and others above the line, but that was it. In Denver, they were offering rebates of more than 50% of their money back on everyone above and below the line, which blew us out of the water financially. And the show was not financed by a studio or network. It was independent through new media. So it's a big lesson. And I look at it, not negatively, but positively. It's a big opportunity for us to get in there. We can still compete because we have and continue to have better crews and facilities in British Columbia and Alberta than they do in Denver, Colorado. So we've got more to offer. We're in the same time zone. And I have to admit, too, that, you know, those pictures that come to British Columbia, many come for locations, spectacular mountain locations, but most, frankly, can be shot anywhere, and they come for the crews, and they come for the value of shooting in this province and in Canada.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent point, George. And just, you know, having listened to you lead in different positions in this industry, from production managing to business representative to gaffing, can you tell me, you know, what is it that you look for when you're putting together your crews? What is it that makes them so good?
Well, the obvious one is originally when we were setting up, and you know, the biggest single thing that I feel we ever did, or I know we ever did, was closing the border on Buffalo Bill and the Indians, and insisting that foreign productions, i.e., in that case, Hollywood productions, hire Canadians first. And that became government policy in 75. And we also established at that time that credits equal to the task were at least 3 pictures, as in a particular job classification. So as a gaffer or a key grip or whatever. And so it was that 3-picture rule that that everyone was aiming at to get their next picture. Fortunately, in those days, we also matched, just like the stage local did. You know, you bring in a gaffer, you can't do that until you hire a Canadian And but we'll put a Canadian gaffer in, and then you can bring yours in on a match basis. But that got us another credit and another credit. Now, we've got so many credits for people in the industry that it's easy pickings for the foreign producers.
You know, George, is that kind of lobbying that you did that really helped create some of the best skilled technicians that we have? You talk about the matches, and, you know, we still have matches on shows today, but what a wonderful sort of learning opportunity for folks up here. And then, of course, that knowledge is passed down and passed down and passed down. As you know, that's how it happens on set, that practical learning. So all that lobbying that was done in the 70s, that's what helped, you know, create our world-class reputation.
That's right.
All right, George, is there anything else you wanted to share with us? Or
just to hit on the 2 points. The one, of course, was the hiring of Canadians before allowing anyone else in, and you had to have a Canadian work permit issued by Government Canada in order to work in Canada. That was the biggest thing, and that was right across Canada. When I went to Fox years ago in the 80s, I happened in on Mark Evans at Fox, and he was budgeting a show called Deadly Weekend in Palm Springs. He told me to go away because I was darkening his door all the time and had no plans on shooting in Vancouver. Thank you. And but he had a problem doing Palm Springs because of the budget. I told him we could do Palm Springs better than Palm Springs in Vancouver, even though it was February. So he took me up on it. He said, we'll do it. But he said, if we don't have a good experience, don't ever call on me again. So he came up. He did Masterpiece of Murder at the time in 85. And it was a wonderful success. And that was Bob Hope. That was his only, I think, television movie that he'd ever done. So that was certainly one of the high points. The other high point, of course, was art directors. And on Harry Tracy, Desperado, we got into a situation there where the Directors Guild was wanting to take over the jurisdiction. We put the question to the Labor Board in British Columbia. We showed a clear history of representation with Local 891 for art directors, and we won. And so that particular case then knit the future for art directors. And they, you know, the art department in general is a very proud component of Local 891 services.
Well, thank you so much, George, for giving us your time and all of the dedication and blazing those paths forward for all of us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, George.
Thank you so much.
And that's a wrap for another episode of Apple Box Talks.
For more episodes and to find your fit in the film and TV industry, check out ourwork.ca.